It's in memory of many and in honor of all. And we thank you, as we typically do on Memorial Day and also on Veterans Day, because today is the day and tomorrow is the day that we will honor those who gave all. And Veterans Day, we honor all of those who gave some. But for those who gave all, if you've had a relative who died in service to our country, we would like for you to stand. Okay. Now, if you are a veteran or currently serving in the military, we would like for you to stand. We thank you for your service. I want to take you on a quick journey, a quick trip. I want us to come down to one lesson. And so I hope you'll pay close attention. I'm going to tell you some things that I think you might find interesting and helpful. We left Birmingham, Alabama. We flew to Atlanta, Georgia. From Atlanta, Georgia, we flew to Paris, France. Don't get excited. We didn't see anything but the inside of an airport. We weren't there very long. And we flew from Paris, France, down to Nigeria. And this is Nigeria. And if we blow Nigeria up, don't read the scale over here. Of course, I say that. This red area, they say, don't travel in. This gold area, they say, reconsider your traveling to this area. And in this area, they say, exercise a high degree of caution. And we landed in Abuja, which is the capital, and from Abuja we drove the 5 hours to Jos. And Jos is where the school is, and that is where we are. I'm going to come back to this map in a moment and let you see. But as far as Nigeria is concerned, this line running through here is the border line, and you can see Jos is right on it. Everything north is Muslim. Everything south, for the most part, is Christian. And the church had a school down in south Nigeria, but there wasn't anything up north. And Jos is sort of the battle area, battleground. Muslims feel like that if they can win Plateau State, which is the state that Jos is in, that if they can win that state and take control of it, they will have Nigeria. And that's why this place is such an important, pivotal place politically for the nation of Nigeria. We'll come back to it in just a minute. Chibok schoolgirls. On April the 14th and April 15th of 2014, 276 girls from the village of Chibok Secondary School, and these girls were all between the ages of 16 and 18, were kidnapped by the Boko Haram in the town of Chibok in Borno State, Nigeria. When the Boko Haram came in, they presented themselves as guards there to protect the girls. And what they had really come to the village for was to get or steal an engine block. But they ran into these 276 plus girls, more than that, and they decided to take them. But they told them they were going to take them to protection, so that they would be protected from the Boko Haram that was coming in. And they loaded them in trucks and they left. Some of the girls figured out that this was not a rescue, and some of them escaped, not nearly in the majority. Only a few of them escaped. And those girls, many of them are still captives to the Boko Haram, although not certain where they are. Some have escaped. Some have been released. Some who are still captives have been sold as brides for 2,000 naira. You go up, buy one of these girls as your bride for 2,000 naira. And 2,000 naira is equivalent to $6. And that's the price you would pay in order to have one of these girls. Sati is his name. Sati is a graduate from the School of Biblical Studies, working in the area of Newman in Adamawa State, which is right next door to where Borno State is, and right very close to Shabak, this village. I was given a list. I'm going to show you the list in just a second by Pat Parker before I left. And it was a list of, I believe it was 10 of the girls that were taken in this raid. And Pat knew the names of these girls and knew their affiliation with the Churches of Christ. And she wanted to know if I could find out what had happened to them. And I'm going to get to that in just a second. So when I got there, I said, I need to find out about these girls. Who can I talk to? They said, you need to talk to Sati. Sati will be here tomorrow. And when Sati came, he and I talked quite a bit. And we became good friends. And we were together some part of every day while we were there. The Friday before we arrived, you have to, let me take just a second. The Boko Haram is being battled against by France and by somewhat Nigerians. Not really so much the Nigerians, because the man who is now president of Nigeria is a Muslim. And he overlooks so many things that happen. But the Boko Haram have been decreased. And so they have infiltrated a tribe. And the tribe is the Fulani tribe. The Fulani tribe are herdsmen. They are nomads. They travel wherever they can to find grass for their cows and for their sheep. And so you drive down the road and you'll see Fulani herds all over the place. Right up next to the road, out in the middle of fields, you'll see them all over the place. And there'll always be two young children, sometime preteen, sometime very young, who will be out in the field with those cows with a stick. And they'll be driving those herds and taking them wherever they need to go. Well, up north, near this area of Chibok, there was a range war, because the people who are farmers plant their crops on their land. The Fulani tribe sees the crops growing, and they bring their herds into the fields, because to them it's an open range. We can feed our cows wherever we wish to. And when that happens, the farmers get angry and they shoot the cows. When they shoot the cows, the Fulanis get angry and they shoot the farmers. As a result of this kind of tribal war, the Boko Haram is using it to their advantage to get rid of Christians. To get rid of Christians in this area. The Friday before we landed in Nigeria, Sani told us that there was a village that was surrounded by Fulani. And the witnesses that were there said that two Nigerian jets and one Nigerian helicopter came in and bombed that village, killing about 80 people who were farmers in that town. The papers in Nigeria are still an open and free press. And they began to write about what was happening. And why wasn't the Nigerian government doing anything about it? Why, every time we ask the Nigerian government, do they just say, we will look into it. We will look into it. But nothing ever happens. As a result of the pressure put on them by the press, while we were there during the lectureship, a Nigerian jet flew over a Fulani village and bombed it. In response to the criticism they were getting from the newspapers. It is a volatile, volatile situation that's going on there. Now, I want to go back to the map, and I want to show you on the map what I'm talking about. Chibok, where those girls were taken, is in this area right here. This is Adamawa State, and this is where Santi lives. He lives right in this area, so he's just across the river from where those girls were taken. These are the names of the girls. Of the girls listed, I asked Santi about them. And Santi said the first two named, Asabi and Sarah, are back home with their family. Santi knows personally their uncle. He knows their father's brother, and he knows for certain that those two girls are back home. As far as the rest, they have no idea. No idea if they're still alive, or no idea if they've escaped or what may have happened to them. And so that's the update on those girls that I was asked to take a look at. Let me tell you something about the School of Biblical Studies in Joss. We have a lot of great mission works across our brotherhood. We have a lot of great mission works that we support. But I don't know of any that are exceeding what this school has done and is doing. Let me give you just a glimpse without going into where these students are in different parts of the world. Just let me summarize it by saying these students from this college or from this school are now scattered all over Africa and in places beyond Africa. There are schools in other countries, in other continents, that are sending their students to Joss to be trained because of what is happening and the impact they are having, these students that come out of the school. Let me give you a brief history of it. The city of Joss is a city of 900,000 people. In 1985, Steve Worley moved there as a missionary, he and his wife and his children. When he moved there in 1985, there was one Church of Christ meeting in Joss. And that one Church of Christ was meeting in a small room in a junkyard. He rented a house, and his next door neighbor turned out to be a fellow Christian who was baptized while he was studying in the United States to get a master's degree so that he could go back and teach at the University of Joss. His name is Solomon Agu. And Solomon has been here on more than one occasion. He lived next door to Solomon Agu, found out he was also a member, and they started attending together the only church in Joss. The school started in 1989, 4 years after he moved there, and 4 years after these two men met. They had already approached us in Gadsden about starting this school. Solomon had already returned to the United States to get his master's degree in Bible from Friedhardman University so that he would be qualified to be the head of a school of biblical studies. And that's in 4 years, all of that had already transpired. And in 1989, the school started with 12 students. Today, the Ring Road Church, which was that only church that met in that junkyard, today Ring Road Church, which is still on the campus of the School of Biblical Studies, has 250 members. There are now 18 congregations of the Churches of Christ in Joss. And there are hundreds scattered not only throughout the rest of Nigeria, northern Nigeria, but in all the countries surrounding it from the impact of this school. There are now 137 students at the school. 36 of them graduated this year. How would you like to be a student at this school? Let me give you a quick breakdown of what life is like for a student at the School of Biblical Studies. At 5:20 in the morning, you get up and you go to the morning devotional. That's Monday through Friday. At 6:20, you have morning cleanup, where you take responsibility for cleaning your dorm and cleaning all of the outside and all of the classrooms and all of the grounds so that everything will look nice and everything will look clean. You eat breakfast from 7:30 until 8 o'clock. You furnish your own food, and you cook in a tin building. I've got a picture of it, but I'm not going to take the time to show it here. And inside of that tin building, there are no tables, there are no chairs. There's just enough room for about four people abreast to stand side by side inside of this place. And in it, there are six kerosene stoves, little heaters. And so on top of those six things that you 136 students will take turns cooking your own food and eating the food that you cook. The good news is they teach them in agriculture. They're doing drip irrigation on campus. And so they raise their own food. And you also have help from your family or help from your church that you came from and help from other means. There are also ladies that come in from the town that cook some food that's there so they have opportunity to eat. But from 7:30 to 8, you eat. Classes begin at 8, and you go classes from 8 until 12. Every student who wants to graduate in 4 years takes 19 to 24 hours per semester, no less. From 12:50 to 1:20, you have the afternoon devotional. From 1:20 to 1:50, you have a short break, the only break you're getting during the day. From 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, you have classes. At 8:50 in the evening, you have your evening devo 3 days a week. The other 2 days, on Wednesday, you have Bible class from 5 to 6. And on Thursday, you have Preacher's Club, and there's a ladies' devo at 6 o'clock. On Saturday, you get up at 9 o'clock. Every Saturday, you go for evangelism. You go to different villages scattered around the area where they have not been working before or they're in the process of establishing a church. And you preach the gospel in those villages every Saturday. If your village is close, you're back to the campus by about 3 or 4 that afternoon. If your village is not close, you will go to that village, you will preach there, you will spend the night, and you will come back to the campus on Sunday. On Sunday, you have worship service, and then Sunday is the day that you wash your clothes. And you hang them up to dry, and you get them ready for the rest of the week. And I think that was it. You have limited power. Electricity is by no means certain. You have no desk in your room. And you have to have lights out because the generator is going to be turned off at 10 o'clock. And you do all of this and you keep up with your studies. I want you to take a look at a sheet that was given. They randomly selected 20 of the 598 graduates who've already graduated from SBS. That's not counting the 36 that graduated this year. Of the 20 they looked at, they totaled 2,762 baptisms. And they just randomly selected 20 students, not counting all of them and all of the things that were done. When I was there the last time, there were three guys who were graduating that year. And those three guys came up to the house and they sang for us. And when they sang a song that really impacted me. And it impacted me this time, not quite as much as then, but just a reminder of it. They sang it in Hausa, which is their native tongue, and then they turn around and sing it again in English. The words of the song are, "I must go with Jesus anywhere, no matter the roughness of the road." And they sing that phrase over and over again. I must go with Jesus anywhere, no matter the roughness of the road. Now here's the lesson for me. And the lesson I want to share with you. I had trepidation about going to Nigeria again. I've had trepidation every time I get on an airplane. And I had trepidation about going, but not like I've had before. Not like I had the last time that I went. And a part of it is this song. To keep it in my mind, I must go with Jesus anywhere, no matter the roughness of the road. Now, I want you to think about these verses. These things I have spoken to you so that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation. But take courage. I have overcome the world. Have you ever noticed the word overcome? And why it's not a different word? Be of good cheer because I have changed the world. But he didn't. Be of good cheer because I've taken all evil out of the world. But he hadn't. Be of good cheer, because I've taken all suffering out of the world. But he had not. In the world, you will have problems. You will have trouble. You will have tribulation. You will have suffering. In the world, you will have tribulation. But take courage. I have overcome the world. What is this world for? What are we here for? Why did God make this world like he did? Do you know what this world is? It is a perfect testing ground for faith in an unseen God. It is perfect testing ground to see who has faith in God and who does not. That's the whole reason God did it. That's why we have choice. Sometimes people ask the question, well, if I live faithful to God here and I die and I go to heaven, how do I know I'll stay faithful in heaven? Could it be that an all-wise, all-knowing God knows that if you go through this world with all that is here, and you remain faithful to him through this world, when you get to heaven and see it, you will never be unfaithful. I also add to that, there's no tempter there. The tempter is destroyed. But the very idea of God putting us here to test faith, to see who will be faithful and who will not. And here is the anthem of what I consider to be the anthem of the faithful. I must go with Jesus anywhere, no matter how rough the road gets to be. Then there's this verse that goes along with it. Then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. I want you to take that down and break it down into normal everyday situations and circumstances. How many people don't do the things they know God would have them to do because it's going to mean too much for them, and therefore they save their life. They save what they want. What they want about their life. But in reality, they've lost it. When I went to Nigeria this time, I had a problem. When I was in Nigeria this time, I had to take antibiotics. And I came home with an infection. But it had nothing to do with Nigeria. It had everything to do with my own backyard. Because when I mowed my grass the Saturday before I left, I had finished mowing the grass and came in the house, I had a tick embedded in me. We removed the tick, and I was almost certain that the head was still on the tick. And I felt very comfortable about it. Didn't think any more about it until I got to Nigeria. When I got to Nigeria, I felt a bump where the tick had been. And there was a little redness where the tick had been. My doctor, knowing I was going to Nigeria, said, I want to send you a prescription for antibiotics. And if something were to happen while you're there and you get sick, I want you to start taking these antibiotics. So I called Jane and I said, I've got this bump where the tick was. I'm not sure what to do. Well, Jane called the doctor. And the doctor said, tell him to take the antibiotics. I took the antibiotics. On the third day after taking the antibiotics, after I'd taken the third pill, my fingers are swelling. And my fingers are swelling to the point that my loose ring is no longer loose. So I'd stopped taking the medication. I stopped taking the medication. The swelling goes down. Come home. The doctor says, you'll never be on that medication again. We'll put you on a list, and that one you won't have anymore. All the concerns for what might happen to me if I go there all happened before I ever left my house. The only thing that went wrong was before I left my house. Do you think we're safer here than they are there? We have people walking in school buildings, killing children. Are we safer here than they are there? We have so many different things that happen in our country where we are. And we consider that a danger zone? How can Santi work in that area knowing that it's overwhelmed with Muslims? He knows where the danger places are. He knows where the safe places are. He knows how to conduct himself. You know where to go. You know where not to go. You know how to conduct yourself because you're aware of those things. All of this to me illustrates a quotation that comes from C.S. Lewis. This is going to be a little hard for you to follow, but I want you to look at it. I want you to think about it. I want you to see how understanding it can impact all of our lives. C.S. Lewis wrote this. If you think of this world as a place intended simply for our happiness, don't read anymore. Stop right there for a second. Do you view this world as a place that ought to be heaven on earth? Do you try to make this place heaven on earth? How are you doing so far? You don't get there. So if you think of this world as a place intended simply for our happiness, you find it quite intolerable. Think of it as a place for correction, faith building, and faith defining, and it's not so bad. Imagine a set of people all living in the same building. Half of them think of it as a hotel. The other half think of it as a prison. Those who think of it as a hotel might regard it as quite intolerable. If where I'm living is a hotel, then everybody associated with this hotel needs to be serving me. Everybody associated with this hotel needs to be concerned about my comfort. Why isn't the water hot? Why does not the shower work? Why is it that I have this comforter on my bed instead of a blanket, which is much more comfortable than a comforter? Why is it that I don't have clean towels today? If this is a hotel, then I am here to be served. I am here for everyone to serve me and to make me happy. And this hotel I find to be quite intolerable. I just don't like it. And those who thought it a prison might decide that it really was surprisingly comfortable. It's a lot more comfortable than I thought it was. It's a lot better than I thought it was. So that what seems the ugly doctrine is one that comforts and strengthens you in the end. The people who try to hold on to an optimistic view of this world would become pessimistic. And the people who hold a pretty stern view of it become optimistic. This is not heaven. And Jesus didn't change it to become heaven. He overcame it. And in this world, where we have all these problems and sufferings, we can have peace. Because of Him and because of where we're going in Him. And it changes the whole focus of how you look at things. I wouldn't trade my trip to Nigeria for anything. I'm so glad I went. We'll make arrangements for all of you to go next time. I'm kidding. We couldn't afford it. You can make arrangements for yourself to go. But that just to me hits home at the very heart of so many things that are wrong with the way we look at things and the way we think. We need to understand this place is not heaven. This place is a place of tribulation. This place is a place where it's going to be filled with it. where we're going to have all kinds of problems. But this is the place where we prove that we have faith in Jesus Christ, that we have faith in God, and we're headed to the place that will be heaven. We're headed to the place where we will be with Him forever. Are you in Christ? Do you need to come home to Christ? We offer you His invitation.